The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
This episode of All the President's Minutes is brought to you by a brand new thriller out now on DVD and digital platforms all around Australia and the world, The Bay of Silence. It's based on Lisa St. Alban de Taran's haunting novel of the same name, and it's written by our guest today on the show. It's a psychological thriller. It stars Claes Bang, Olga Kurylenko, and the awesome Brian Cox. It's an international thriller in the tradition of films like Gone Girl or The Girl on the Train and Ask Questions. How well do you know your partner? Here's a little clip from the trailer.
Please say yes.
It's heaven.
There you are!
More radiant than ever.
Oh my God.
Still spoiling her, Milton.
I am in a position to help.
Financially.
I can look after us.
Don't be too proud, Will.
We have many publications that are dedicated to promoting the cause of climate change and radical action on climate change. So that's okay, is it? It's okay to be a propagandist for one side, but if one is a critic or sceptic about some of these issues, that's not okay.
And so what you've just disclosed is the fundamental problem that the company you work for and its friends in politics like Trump and others have turned this issue of physics into an issue of values or identity. Now, saying that you believe or disbelieve in global warming is like saying you believe or disbelieve in gravity. You've turned something that should be a question of engineering and economics into undiluted ideology and idiocy, and we are paying the price in delayed action to address global warming. And your employer, Paul, has got a huge share of the blame for this. It is a shocking legacy.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to All the President's Minutes. I'm your host, Blake Howard. It's the 123rd episode of this minute-by-minute podcast analysis series. And sometimes I utterly fluke an amazing guest, and that is today. So in the series, you know, I'm often tinkering, planning. We've been talking to historians, journalists, lecturers, film people, actors, editors. And it just so happens that my great guest today is someone who is an actor who's acted in some of the biggest movies almost ever, who is now trying a hand for the first time in a later part of her career as a writer. And it's just an absolute thrill to get to bring a craftsperson to talk about the craft of this movie. It is 123 minutes. That's more than 2 hours into this bad boy. And so why not get someone who's acted in the Royal Shakespeare Company? Why not get someone who's acted in little films about historical events, you know, Oscar winning best pictures like Schindler's List, or acted in films like Cliffhanger and Hook and Disclosure. And one of my personal favorites is she's in White Squall, a very underseen Ridley Scott movie with Jeff Bridges, which is just divine. If you get a chance, we might talk about that a little bit later, but has now very, very recently just tried a hand at both acting and writing a film called The Bay of Silence. It's my distinct pleasure to welcome Caroline Goodall to All the President's Minutes. Caroline, thank you so much for making the time to be on the show.
Oh, Blake, thank you so much for having me. This is really exciting.
So, I mean, I've been deep diving on your resume and on your career, but I want to know, like, as an individual now, because you've had this international cosmopolitan career where you've worked in the States and you've worked and you live and work overseas, and you've also spent some time in Oz. What's your relationship as an actor to New Hollywood and to films like All the President's Men? Is this your seminal years as a moviegoer? Is this the kind of years that you were like looking at movies and going, I'm going to do this. I'm going to be an actor.
You're too damn right. You looked up how old I am. Can I just quickly shout out to all my wonderful family and friends in Australia, all the Islands and the messengers in Sydney and in Melbourne, you know, all my 31st cousins, all my aunts and uncles, and just say I am so sorry that I am not there with you. We can't have our red carpet moment with my film coming out, The Bay of Silence. But I love you all, and thank you. Just want to give a shout out in case they're listening.
And also, days ago, because there are quite a contingent of people who listen in Melbourne, only days ago cinemas just opened in Melbourne. So in Sydney, we can't have you here in person to see this thing and get a proper premiere and sort of claim you, as we often do with international people, just claim you as an Australian for the purposes of
this. I am an Aussie. Passport. I'm more Australian than anything.
You keep that passport, right? New Zealand and Aussie passports are a very valuable thing these days.
Exactly. But,
I was just having a look back and I was looking at your career, and I had to ask, because I would imagine, I think all of us cinephiles my age, and then you're just ahead of me, I look at that and I go, you know, we'd had another era of films that were influenced by the 1970s that came afterwards. And then we're kind of looking back at the 90s, which is kind of bastardizing everything that happened in the 80s and the 70s together. And you're taking off out of the Shakespeare Company in that early 90s period and are hitting such an amazing purple patch of your career right at some of the big cinema movies in the 90s. But I always look back at those 90s actors, those 90s performers, and even those working directors. And I think a lot of these folks started early days, New Hollywood, late 70s, or inspired by or started training. And that's all the energy they bring to their career.
Totally. The 70s, I think, is one of the great eras of movie making. You know, this particular film, 1976, All the President's Men, with these great artists at the height of their powers, one of whom, of course, I went on to work with and Hook, Dustin Hoffman.
I know.
And directed by Alan J. Pakula. It's completely that period that I certainly was steeped in growing up. I was a teenager during this period. I was a huge movie goer and theater goer. And these films stay with you, they resonate, and they are extraordinary. This particular movie, of course, my God, I mean, when you sent me that clip of Ziegler as the press secretary defending Nixon and the Watergate conspiracy, and it's like nothing's happened since Trump playbook it's incredible, actually, to witness. And I think it's very important, actually, for us. I am going back to watch that film tonight because what we don't realize is that things are cyclic. And actually, exactly what they're doing now, they've learned from the past and they're doubling down because they realize that, he should, maybe he shouldn't have actually resigned. but we always think that we're in the worst moment in history.
Yes.
That we're living through it now. And the only thing I can say with a bit of benefit of hindsight is there have been lots of worst moments in history. And to look back at that particular clip that you asked me to look at and compare it to now, it's just extraordinary, the parallels. And it makes me feel two things. It makes me feel both a little depressed that we haven't really got anywhere, but at the same time, also, it gives me a certain level of hope that regardless of the dark times that we think we're in, we as human beings do have the extraordinary capacity to be able to find the good, to find the compassion in ourselves, to look for the truth. And I do think that that's the great thing about films. And actually, you know, my own film, I will digress, but is also about a search for the truth. Most films are. And, you know, that's, so this is the great thing, is this film is about the press. It's about freedom of the press. It's about telling the truth. It's about finding the truth, following the money, just such a sort of precursor of how we have to continue to be vigilant.
Yes.
In every way, every generation, there will be a group of people who are going to try and subvert freedom for their own ends. And we just have to stand up and constantly be counted. And the extraordinary thing is, a pandemic, of course, is the perfect time to subvert your freedom. Yeah. And artists and writers and, you know, the media, whatever you want to call them, the fourth estate, who, yes, we do know, can manipulate in the most terrible way, because there are two sides, of course, to the media. And, you know, we know that Rupert Murdoch's got a lot to answer for.
You essentially being an Aussie would know probably more intimately than anyone in our small country here, how influential that stranglehold can be.
Oh, absolutely. But I'll tell you something else. My mother's a journalist. She was on the Sydney Sun before it became the Sun Herald. My father was a book distributor and newspaper distributor as well. And so actually the Maxwells and the Murdochs and that whole era and the Fairfaxes were people who were known pretty well to my parents. And of course, I heard a lot of stories growing up. I think it's only by slight default that I'm not a journalist. This is probably why the writing and the scribbling came in, because my mother was, you know, a great writer. And books were just, you know, it was, well, you can see behind me here, but yeah, you know,
your great home library is stacks on stacks on stacks behind you.
There's a lot of Italian ones.
Well, this is the thing. In preparation for the show, and as we're sort of ramping up to the finish line now, I've watched these scenes in and out of order many times now in preparation to talk to you. And literally today, because we're all doom scrolling on our Twitter feeds or on our news feeds, and you're just seeing the clips of, especially the whole not contesting the loss of the election stuff. And this Ziegler scene is like, you couldn't time it better to say, if there's one thing that the Republican Party seemed to learn from this period, is that Nixon's playbook is, we deny, 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 deny until it is literally too late. And until it is, no matter how bad we have to perjure ourselves, we're going to deny everything because someone didn't have a testimony on that day in that way. But it doesn't matter. We're just going to go hard in the paint. And you just see these journalists, and what's great in the following scenes, which we can slightly cheat on before we actually get to the moment to watch it together, I just go, thank God for some vigilance of going, you know, Bradley's great phrase and obviously Jason Robards' delivery, fuck it, we'll stand by the boys. Like, there's just nothing more that you need than to go, no, we stand by our story. This is what it is. This is the facts. We're going to be vindicated. It's you guys who are actually lying. And it's insane. It's an insane film to watch this year and examine minute by minute this year, let me tell you.
It certainly is, isn't it? And of course, the other insane thing is that Bob Woodward has written two books on Trump, and Trump was very happy to talk to him about his playbook too. I mean, it's an extraordinary thing about Trump is that he certainly doesn't even try to hide what he's doing.
As a podcaster and someone who interviews someone, you know, I'm so grateful for, like, oh, great, can I get an hour? Oh, yeah, you can have over an hour. They've got an hour and a half gap. You should be great. Not a problem.
Yeah.
Trump gives 18 hours to Bob Woodward as a president and purges himself like daily while he's doing that. And he's like one of the greatest journalists in American history, just taking notes. All right, here we go. We're going to do this. Insanity.
Totally is. So tell me how this works. So are we going to play this and we're going to talk through it
as it goes?
So
because some people,
camera movement.
Absolutely.
And the actors and choices of framing and all that stuff.
You know,
you know,
I'm going to keep all this in because I guarantee you there's going to be new people listening when they see your name on this episode. So I'm going to say exactly that. Caroline right now and I are going to watch this minute together. Everyone who's listening along are purely going to listen to the minute, and then we're going to come back and we can unpack all of these wonderful choices and the fact that this scene, which just hangs on this sensational bit of real life footage, archival footage, So many great performances in faces, in gestures, in scrunched up bodies, in framing. It's just a masterwork. So we're going to watch that 60 seconds right now. We're going to come back and talk about it.
Time later at the White House, News Secretary Ronald Ziegler delivered a strong attack on the Washington Post.
Why is the Post trying to do it? You have a man who's the editor of the Washington Post by the name of Ben Bradley. I think anyone who would want to honestly assess what his political persuasions are would come to the conclusion quite quickly that he is not a supporter of President Nixon. So I respect the free press. I don't respect the type of journalism, the shabby journalism that is being practiced by the Washington Post. All I know is that the story that ran this morning is incorrect, and has been so stated as being incorrect by not only me, but by the individual whose grand jury, secret grand jury testimony they based their story on. And that individual has denied that he ever so testified.
No sooner had Ziegler finished than the president's campaign manager.
There it is, Caroline.
Okay.
What a sensational 60 seconds to talk about.
It really is, isn't it? Well, of course, we've spoken about the context of it and what it was about a little just prior to that. But of course, quick backtrack, Ziegler, who in fact seemed to be the only, you know, he was one of the few who was loyal to Nixon right to the end.
Yes.
He was his press secretary. He had been... What I found interesting also was he didn't have a journalistic background, and most press secretaries did. And it was part of a push by Nixon to undermine the press by not having someone who was a journalist talking to other journalists. So he was outside of the media, which I think is really interesting. But in terms of the actual shooting of it, what I find really interesting, because it is only 60 seconds, and to kind of unpack 60 seconds of cuts is, but I mean, the great thing about Pakula is, number one, this is a handheld scene.
Yes.
The camera is using certain cinema verite, you know, techniques, which of course is used throughout the whole thing, you know, sort of documentary style. And this is one of the few movies, and perhaps you've said this, I don't know, where this idea of the sort of documentary feel and that spontaneity and flying on the wall was starting to be used in filmmaking in increasing manner as part of, as you said, this sort of 70s new wave kind of feel. Whereas before, you know, movies had, you know, would tend to be more formal.
Yes.
So there's this sort of lack of formalism. But what it does, of course, is it takes you right into the center of what's going on. You feel the emotions. Interesting close up, you start on Robards. And then
what
you
a
move
face
to the others. You amazing face. You start on their faces and you hear the beginning of the press conference, and then you go to the television. You're this wonderful old.
I miss it, Caroline. I want a button. Give me a. We had a TV in a spare room. I can't find the remote. I just want a button. I have to reach behind and unlock the damn thing. It's so frustrating.
So much easier, isn't it? It really is. And then you go. So you've got, and he cuts, you know, he doesn't sort of, he just goes big close up on Robards looking bit glum.
Mm.
Then cut to another close up, then cut to the TV, and you just on this archive footage on the television, and then back to a three, which is interesting, of the three main newsmen, just as Ziegler's saying he's undermining the press. He says shabby journalism.
Shabby journalism.
And they look at each other for a moment. But what's interesting is Pakula also has taken the temperature out of the room a bit, in that he's told them, basically, be very cool, be very calm. This is, you know, you are professionals. We don't, you know, this is a very shocking moment. But you can tell in the direction he's told the actors, don't give the shock for the audience. Let the audience feel the shock by listening and just by looking at your faces as you just kind of look at each other in disbelief, but without a huge amount of overt emotion. And a choice could have been that they would have just all gone, you know, thrown pieces of paper up in the air and shouted at the screen. I mean, that's another way of doing it, shouting yes. at the screen, saying, you fucker, how could you, blah, blah, blah. But it wasn't. It's sort of done in this sort of silence. And of course, therefore, that's why it's just more effective, because they're letting us join in that scene and be the audience with the journalists there. And then you get that two shot, of course, on Woodward and Bernstein, and they look at each other and you can see that that's that turning point for them.
Yes.
They're not going back now. That is the turning point where they are going to double down themselves. I mean, what has just been laid in front of them is actually the gauntlet has just been thrown down. And I think what's interesting is that in a way, it's sort of like a shootout of the OK Corral. You know, one side through the TV, you've got Ziegler, who's coming out of...
You're in Italy. This is pure Sergio Leone. I can't believe that you said it, because I literally have it in my notes, because it's Robards is a Leone guy face. It is a standoff, and it's so brilliant to hear. And I think I'm so grateful to talk to you about this scene in particular, because I think it's so great to get your insight to go as an actor and now as a screenwriter and someone who's been on the stage, taking the temperature out of that room. It's kind of like that, you know, that old silly cliche, and you've got kids, so you'll probably say it. It's like, I'm not mad, I'm disappointed, because that's this moment. Because like, you're expecting fury and you're like, Jesus, because you hear in just the preceding minute, we get the infamous Woodstein that's shouted through the cavernous newsroom. They're all the way at the other end. They walk all the way through to witness this moment, and they don't get a dressing down live. They get what is unfathomably brutal silence, and having to hear Ziegler just shout the worst possible barbs at them, which is shabby journalism, which these three guys, Harry Rosenfeld, Simons and Bradley, so beautifully played, you know, Balsam and Jack Warden, both in 12 Angry Men, which is just giving a whole, you know, different cinematic legacy and energy to the scene too. But they're there disappointed, and both the guys look bitterly disappointed in themselves as they're continuing to watch in that final two. For as you said, it's just this is why I do projects like this, because the great movies do not have a second, not a minute wasted. And this could totally have been another scene, but like you said, such a power to take the temperature out of the movie right before the climax, take the temperature out and make you dwell in their disappointment.
It's so, so true. But I think this is the great thing when you analyze films, and why we can go and see great films over and over again, because each scene is a three-act structure.
Yes.
It doesn't matter how short a scene is. It's still got a beginning, a middle, and an end. And, of course, a film has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And so there's all those little three-act structures that then go into a larger sequence. It's got a three-act structure that then is packed into a larger sequence with a three-act structure. And that is something that the writer and, you know, the director and the actors always have to keep in the back of their mind. What is the pace of a scene as well? And where does it fit in the whole of the story that you're telling? And I think this is also one of the things why I actually love feature films. And I know that we're so into long form television at the moment and talking about this renaissance in writing and TV, but I can hold a film in my head.
Yes.
I can hold that story in my head and I can go back to it and I can think about it. The issue I have with long form television, when you've got these huge arcs of storylines and also inevitable multi-character storylines that have to happen because you've got 10 episodes to fill plus another 5 seasons.
Yes.
is that I can't hold those stories in my head so well. I so enjoy them while I'm watching them. I'm absolutely obsessed. And, you know, when you get that seconds and it's ticking away and that you think, oh, God, I have to watch the next episode and it's 2 o'clock in the morning. but there is something for all of us filmmakers about making feature films that is just really compelling and satisfying about telling a story in a three-act structure with a beginning, a middle, and an end that we can encompass in our heads. And The Bay of Silence for me is also like that. People said, I just think, yes, but, you know, and when you talk about the 70s, what's interesting is that, of course, at the same time, you've got Nick Rogue.
Yes.
You've got,
Peter Weir.
Yes. Peter Weir, I mean, you've got a whole burgeoning of the new Australian film industry as well at that moment as well, mm-hmm. which is coming through thanks to a bit of grant funding, might I say. But the thing about Bay as well is that when we were talking about the look, we actually wanted to have that retro 70s sort of feel about it.
Yes.
We looked at the work of Nick Rogue. I mean, I do think, you know, I mean, Don't Look Now definitely was an inspiration for the feel of the piece, as well as Polanski and as well as Hitchcock. But in terms of just the design, the shooting style that Guido van Gennep and Paola wanted to adopt, which, you know, they looked at bad timing, for example, and we used anamorphic lenses, and those shots where you might have a close-up but someone's in the sort of corner of a screen and there's some sort of black or blank on the other side, the dark, because also that helps to a certain extent with suspense and with mystery. But it's a cinematic language that is a little bit more formal, even though at the time, you know, then it wasn't formal.
It's the bridge, yeah, I think, that you're talking about, which is going, there is this, and in Presidents, and I think in Bay, there is like stringent formalism for some parts of it, which make it so, you know, it plays to that, those enigmatic qualities. And, you know, you go to the car park scenes. There's nothing more formalist than the car park scene or a house, a creepy seaside house on a French hill. Like, there's nothing, you know, as in Bay, there's these creepy moments that are really stringently formalist, but then that there is
really
another
gothic.
Really gothic. Yeah. And then there's other energy. And I think that it's the ability to make whatever that tone is, that it seems totally plausible and seamless to go from, you know, a romantic, you know, beautiful, you know, picturesque into fearful, gothic, scary, like those moments. And I just want to reiterate something for you that you said, I think is so powerful as well, is that's, I'm so like you with cinema. I have so many friends that go, do you want to watch this series? It's great. I go, how many? The first thing I say, because I'm just ruthless, I go, how many episodes is it? And they're like, oh, it's 24 episodes a season. They're 45 minutes each. There's 6 seasons. And I go, there is no way in hell I'm watching one even episode. Like, I go, do you know how many films I could watch? Do you know how many great films I haven't seen? Like, there's like lists of curated, amazing, long lists of great films. I'm like, you would never catch me dead watching all of that. Like, it's just not going to happen. And that's why I think, you know, another one of my friends of the show who's an author and a screenwriter, Jordan Harper, he says, Blake, I love a tight 90. And that's exactly what Bay of Silence is. I love a tight 90-minute movie. Tight 90. Get in. Get out. I want you to tell me a story. I want really effective, lean storytelling. I want to be entertained or moved or creeped out or, you know, affected by a script. And then I want to get out of there. And you just can't do that with a 7-year commitment to a Game of Thrones. You can't do that. And that's my thing, is I find something so rewarding in great films and just really efficient storytelling. There's a definite art to that than, you know, the more languid pieces that you get to go as long as you like and there's no boundaries.
Oh, I'm very with you there, although actually I am a Game of Thrones fan, and actually I've just recently I was shooting during the pandemic in Dubrovnik. We were picking up 5 days on a film called The Islander, which is kind of quite cool, which hopefully will be coming out next year, sort of steampunk, sci-fi, futuristic thing. But I have to tell you, I did get a bit of a kick sitting on the Game of Thrones throne in the island of Dubrovnik, and I was alone. I was alone.
You were all by yourself.
I was alone with the throne. I did selfies, but actually, unfortunately, there was no. I needed someone to take a proper picture of me because, in fact, it doesn't look good.
But
it was just extraordinary because, of course, there was no tourists there. It was quite amazing.
Oh my God! Well, that alone with the throne, there's another story entirely. All right, so you've had such an amazing career as an actor, and I think that one of the things we have to talk a bit about is your film here is that. I think that in your film, one of the biggest compliments I can give you in Bay of Silence is I had absolutely no idea where this thing was going. And I don't necessarily think that it wasn't like a clockwork mystery. It was, you didn't have a staunch, gumshoe detective that was going through and putting all the pieces together. You had these people floundering around these facts and floundering around this discomfort and these challenging moments. But I found it really amazing to be completely and utterly shocked by the movie without spoiling. Because I don't want to spoil anything. I just want to say that I was shocked and I was affected, and it was just an incredible piece. And so I have to ask, it's one of your first adaptations. How did the book, which I understand is drastically different from the film, how did it all happen? How did this happen for you?
Oh God, I probably have a really weird imagination. I think I came at it from the point of view, as I said, of wanting to write a mystery thriller. And I really do like those movies from the 70s, The Don't Look Nows and The Vanishing. They were really two great inspirations for me, but partly because their themes are very similar. You've got the death of a child in Don't Look Now, and in The Vanishing, you've got a man who goes looking for his girlfriend who's disappeared into thin air. I was inspired by those films. And I also, there are themes that are buried, or maybe not too deep, in this film that are quite demanding.
Yes.
And for me, when you when you try to make a movie and you're an actor, and also a woman, dare I say it, they want you to make low budget, start with something easy and with a low budget and a horror movie, please.
Yeah.
Because you don't need stars for horror movies. There's a huge, following out there, and it's sort of seen as a sort of safe place, especially for women. Horror movie, you could do that, or yes, you could do a nice kind of girly comedy. I guess I'm either stupid or overambitious. And I felt that if I was really going to double down and be lead producer, which is what I ended up being on this film as well, and, finding the money and putting the team together and, the main cast and everything, I didn't want to have just, a few hundred thousand to play with and work just as hard. I wanted a little bit more money than that.
Yeah, yeah.
And to do something that, maybe be the only thing that, I ever managed to do. So, let's at least have some really great people in it. Let's go to 3 countries and let's try and raise enough money for it. And I have to tell you, it's still a tiny, tiny budget.
Yes.
And it looked so much bigger. I mean, people have said to me, it must be about 10 million or something. I said, no, it's 3. So I take my hat off to, Paola and Guido for that as well, for, really being able to shoot in such a short period of time and, really make it work and not compromise themselves. But yes, I mean, going back, I just thought, if I'm going to tell a story, I do want it to be about something. I don't want it to be a slasher horror, and I don't necessarily want to flag the end to everybody, who the baddie is. But I did want a feel that within all this, in the same way as a Polanski movie. I mean, if you think of Chinatown, Chinatown is actually about sexual abuse and incest.
Yeah, absolutely.
But we think of Chinatown with that great William Golden script as being about water and kind of like a sort of police thriller with Jack Nicholson being really good.
Yeah, yeah.
We forget, you know, that Houston, the brilliant, you know, Houston plays, it's all about incest. So I think the interesting thing about Bay was also to be able to slide those themes in, all of which we do deal with, probably, you know, we're all very open to, and we know about and deal with in our own lives, not incest so much, but, you know, tough stuff that we all have to face, and put it within that framework of the sort of, you know, more of a Hitchcock-style thriller, and also throw in a way for fun, partly, but also because the audience understands what we're doing, throw in the tropes.
Yeah.
You know, don't hide them. Don't hide the MacGuffin of the suitcase. Don't, you know, find the most gothic house you possibly can on a cliff with, you know, we don't have you know, we've got seagulls are our birds, and they just happen to be there, which was absolutely wonderful. It was like, yes,
quick, shoot the camera where the seagulls are right now.
Exactly, you know, and using that all for the soundtrack as well, and having casting actors who actually do look like classic archetypes. Yeah. As well. I mean, you could put all three of those into those actors into a Hitchcock film, and, you know, make it black and white, put a hat on them, and my God, there they are. They're Rosalind Russell and they're Jimmy Stewart and, you know, they're John Huston. So I think that was the important thing as well, is to have actors who are able to be those archetypes and but also be deeply contemporary as well.
Yeah.
So because that is what we need from our actors. We need very, very, you know, we're used to modern acting. We're used to total kind of naturalness. But at the same time, I like a bit of formalism, as you said, too. So there was a lot of balancing going on and discussions about how to make that work. As well, and also in terms of the production design. And then you just kind of hope that all of that work goes in there and might be picked up, but not necessarily, it doesn't matter, but that it's got a kind of coherent whole on its own. And yes, you know, the A and B plot do kind of collide, and there is a lot of going on, and there are red herrings, and I'm glad that you couldn't figure out in a way. And, you know, perhaps we could have been a bit clearer about things, but
that wasn't a criticism. It was more like, I think, you know, you're talking about Chinatown. There's a really great book called The Big Goodbye. I've mentioned a couple of times in this show, which is a terrific book that charts the life of Polanski, the life of Robert Towne, the writer, the life of Jack Nicholson. Oh my God, his name escapes me. He was the producer at Paramount. I'm going to forget his name. I'm going to look it up while we're talking, but it talks about all of those guys and the inspirations that they all brought to bear. So with Nicholson and Towne, it was a deep relationship. Towne was writing about this exactly cyclical worst time in the world, inherent corruption of Los Angeles through the prism of water in the 1930s. Because,
oh God, did I say William Goldman script?
You said Goldman. Yes, sorry, you said Goldman. Town, Robert Towne. Towne. I knew who you meant. I knew we would fix it up when we were talking about it. But it was like. So when Towne's writing that script, he's writing it exactly as you said, because he's experiencing what he feels is like the worst moment in his life and the worst moment of that has ever happened in history. And he goes back and sees the inherent corruption in the 30s and like, that's where I want to go and focus. And then Polanski, obviously, as a figure with tragedy that has surrounded his entire life and controversy much later, he brings that in. He brings that into it, and they all bring this different energy. And I think why I said with your film that I didn't really know where it was going is because with, and I'm going to make sure I'm pronouncing it correctly, Klaes Bang. Is that right?
Yes.
Klaes Bang.
Yeah, Klaes. Yeah.
With Klaes, he's not a gumshoe. He's not a detective. He's a man, and he's under immense pressure and stress, and his life has jumped.
He's an ordinary man in extraordinary circumstances. It's that classic.
And so I think if you're just riding this with him, you kind of, you know, I try to go on the ride, and it's hard sometimes when you're a film critic or you're a film fan to not see the tropes, but I also love run towards a trope. Like if it's done, it's executed well, run towards it. But yeah, I think that's what I mean, is that you're in with this guy who's under immense pressure. And if you're just following his emotional trajectory, it doesn't all come into sort of crisp focus until the final act of the movie, which is like where you start to really get those big punches in. And so I think that's a testament to it more than anything. And I definitely agree. There's something frustrating, and you would know this also as an Aussie, is, and I've said it a few times on the show, I miss, like, just give me genre films, like, because a genre film can say things. You don't just have to have it as a vacant vessel that has nothing. You can really say things. And if you're making like a horrific movie and it's a very moody Nicholas Roeg inspired, you know, early Polanski riff about modern times, you can really play with some dark themes that feel very prescient and very real. And so for me, I'm like, this is the perfect kind of movie. Like, let's make 20 more of these. No more TV shows, Netflix for a year. You can't make any more. I want 50 movies like this from every country in the world, because it's like, they're just short and sharp. And so that's kind of where I'm saying is like, you know, I don't think genre is a dirty word. I kind of like, I, you know, the business is the business, which is great to get the insight from you. But in my mind, I think, you know, let 20 more great female filmmakers such as yourself and Paula get together and just make disturbing, horrific movies together, and we can watch them and enjoy them.
Sounds good. I love that idea. Yeah. I have an idea for comedy next.
Yeah. Yeah. You're like, I need a break. And that's okay. That's okay.
It'll probably be a disturbing comedy though.
Yeah.
I mean, I often find, you know, I mean, the weird thing is people say, why does, you know, and I think so interesting. I've met so many kind of people who seem to be generally kind of quite happy and outgoing, but they really love dark stuff.
Yeah.
And it's just one of those things. And like, often dark, moody people, they're the ones who are kind of writing the comedies and, you know.
Yeah. Well, you know,
the comedians are really depressive.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the next project that we're doing as a minute by minute project or as an extensive deep dive is Zodiac, because I just can't get enough of it. It's one of my favorite films, Fincher's Zodiac.
Oh, what, from Zodiac Killer?
The Zodiac Killer, Fincher's film from 2007, starring one of the stars of your movie, Brian Cox, as well. So, but again, extremely dark movie in the grand scheme of things.
Well, you know what? When you do that, we'll have to ring Brian up, and he's going to have to do 60 seconds.
I'm going to call you. That's a promise. Definitely. I think the listeners are here, but yeah. So I look, it's been immensely amazing to talk to you about this 60 seconds of movie.
Too.
And a huge congratulations on the film. And I'm obviously now it's totally unconventional. It's going to go around on VOD and it might get some theaters in Sydney, and the whole world is different, but you know, more movies like this, and congratulations on the film, and just thank you for your insight and your craft. And I think people are going to get a real kick out of hearing you talk about craft so deeply on the show.
Oh, well, thank you. And I just want to say, yeah, you know, I'm sad that, you know, me and my family can't have our red carpet moment. We did get a small opening in the United States, which was really great. And we had our opening actually at the Shanghai International Film Festival, was our main festival opening, that was, you know, kind of good. But then after, you know, it was just like the pandemic's just kind of stopped everything short. I will say, though, that this film, I think, is going to be absolutely okay on, you know, the smaller screen. I've even seen it on the phone because I wanted to see how it stood up. And I was actually, you know, I thought, wow, actually that works. It's fine. So from that point of view, even though we did use anamorphic lenses and it looks incredible on the big screen, and the grade it's just amazing, and the sound is so good, it also can be viewed because it is a character piece. and essentially. So
you're gonna sneak some people on the aeroplane too. Someone's gonna see beautiful people being attractive in the seaside and go, what are they watching? I'm gonna get, when people get on planes again, they're gonna go, what are they watching? Oh, what's that called? Bay of Silence? That sounds like it might be fun. It sounds like it might be fun, and you'll turn it on and it will absolutely shake people to the core and disturb people. And that's you know, the best possible thing.
But I love that on the long haul flights, you know, I like to see four or five films. I'll usually mix it up with a classic, something really disturbing, and then perhaps, you know, a popcorn movie. But I just quickly want to say that Betsy Hamlin, shout out to her, of Cine Sky, was my first investor. She bought the film for blinds because she actually, I happen to know her and she's an old mate up the hill. And I said, could you read the script? And she said, this is not normally something I'd for an airline because actually it's a little disturbing and we try and stay away from, you know, anything to do with child death or anything like that. But she said, I read this and she said, I'm buying it. And then of course, poor Betsy, this year, she hasn't been able to sell one movie to, you know, so she's sitting in Wisconsin tearing her hair out, hoping that, you know, things will get better next year. So shout out to Betsy, who is great. And actually, she bought The Dressmaker too, and she came down to Australia and hung out with it all there too. So they're all filmmakers, these distributors as well. And, you know, we often give them a bad time and a hard run because, yes, you know, they do, you know, want their money, but they live or die by films. We all do, and theatre, of course, you know, this is that's desperate. So I'm just so glad Australia's been so smart coming out of lockdown. No new cases yesterday in Melbourne, I think.
No new cases for like 11 consecutive days. In Sydney, I think we did have a day of three very recently, but no, we've been very...
and two in the Blue Mountains or something odd. But, you know, I'm keeping tabs on it because, you know, I said to my mum, who's 90 and wants to go back and see her, her sisters, you know, let's just get, you know, as soon as we can, let's just get on a plane and go over there.
Come back.
But we're about to go to, here in Italy, we've been really good, but now we're going into yellow and then maybe orange and, of course, in the UK. So it's just a mess. So everybody just stay indoors and enjoy the exterior if you can, but do watch movies because, you know, every single time you buy a download to a film, it's not much more than a glass of vino that you're not having with your friends. And so you can donate that to the filmmakers, please.
I think that's emphatic enough. I'm going to put links in the descriptions of the show and on the website oneheatminute.com about where you can find Bay of Silence in Oz and where it's showing and if it's on VOD where you can link to it. Caroline, thank you so much again. This has just been wonderful talking to you.
Oh, it's just been such a pleasure. And thank you for inspiring me. And I'm going to watch All the President's Men tonight.
Wow. Thank you so much, Caroline Goodall, for being a part of the show. I'm just immensely proud of everything we've done. And I'm so thrilled that people like Caroline, in the process of just spruiking her own movie, would be willing to come on the show and talk about it and give such rich insights. I'm extremely grateful. Thank you again. Guys, I hope you enjoyed that chat as much as I did. If you want to support us this time, you can support our great guest Caroline by going and finding The Bay of Silence. You can find that on DVD, you can find that on video on demand. There'll be links in the description of the show to go and do that. Thank you so much, just for the price of a vino, as Caroline put it. Thank you for listening to All the President's Minutes. We're on the downhill slope of the show at ATPM Pod on Twitter, oneheatminute.com. And if you want to follow me, it is oneblakeminute on Twitter and Instagram. We have a great lineup of guests that continue all the way to the finish line on this. Thanks for your support. Keep listening. Nothing's at stake except the Constitution of the United States and maybe the future of the country.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.